Helen. Let me say first what a pleasure it is to be here, basically on home ground. In spite of the fact that it is just a tiny bit chillier here than where I presently live. And I also want to say here, it really was an inspiring idea, decision on your part to bring our parents' library to this campus. And it's very moving to me to see that piece of our lives restored and kept in its integrity here where others can peruse and enjoy and get a feel for the balance of interests and influences that made up our family in the middle of the 20th century. I want to do something quite different from what Peter did, which is to talk about our father's economics, John Kenneth Galbraith's economic ideas, and what bearing they have on the world in which we presently live. I would say that in the beginning, there was agriculture. Dad started on a farm, and his very first writing was for the local paper, an anonymous column under the signature of the Plowman, describing the virtues of non-tubercular cows and a good coat of lead paint on the barn farming practices. He went on, we've already discussed this in the other setting, to the Ontario Agricultural College, and then from there to Giannini Hall Center for Agriculture Economics at Berkeley. And this line of authority he carried with him all through his later life, right up to the point in 1960 in the presidential campaign when John F. Kennedy said to him, "Ken, I don't want to hear about farm policy from anyone except you, and I don't want to hear about it from you either." Still, even after that, there were moments when he could make use of this foundational expertise. Peter already quoted one letter to Kennedy on Vietnam. In another, he warned against sending combat troops to the Mekong Delta in the guise of flood relief, writing that floods in this part of the world are an old trap for the Western non-agriculturalists. They judge the Mekong by what the Ohio does to its towns. Then, in the early 1930s, possibly even a little bit before, there was Veblen, Thorstein Veblen, the Norwegian-American from Minnesota, whose lasting influence, I think, lay partly in the stiletto prose and partly in seeing the rich, the leisure class, as a fitting object of study, of investigation, from a detached, even anthropological point of view, unblinking in the knowledge of the discomfort that this would cause. There is nothing that the leading figures of our society like less than to be investigated in a quiet, relentless tone of voice or pen. And Dad carried this pleasure with him, I think, through all the rest of his life. In the 1970s, he mounted with the BBC a magnificent effort to survey the history of economic thought and current economic problems, a television series called The Age of Uncertainty, led to a book. And in the section on Veblen, they constructed a vast museum of natural history, Darwinism and social Darwinism. And so next to the woolly mammoth and the saber-toothed tiger, there was the figure of a fellow in a top hat and a big belly and covered with a vest and a watch and a sign, Capitalopithecus Robustus. In 1936, there came the discovery of John Maynard Keynes, and in 37, suddenly equipped with a spouse, Dad went to Cambridge to learn from the master, who unfortunately was not there. He was ill that year, but Dad formed ideas and friendships there, overturning but not entirely replacing the body of thought that he had developed before. Keynes's idea, of course, was that you had to think of the flow of spending in the economy as a whole as a central problem, and that the Depression was substantially a failure of the system to provide an appropriate spending power to absorb the unemployed and to put the factories that were available to work. There came quickly a massive test of Keynesian principles in the mobilization for the Second World War. And there, I think less because of his familiarity with Keynes, more because of his work with prominent business leaders and his understanding of some of the problems of the agricultural and industrial sectors in the 20s and 30s in the United States, Dad ended up at this remarkably early age in a position of critical responsibility with control basically over all prices in the United States from shortly after Pearl Harbor until the political pressures became intolerable and he was dismissed in 1943. I asked him once how he found 17,000 people to help him control prices in a few months at the start of World War II. He said land-grant colleges, lots of professors of economics who were a little too old to fight but wanted to do something, he just hired them out. The last time that the economics profession was truly useful, I think. I think Dad remained both pre-Keynesian and post-Keynesian for much of the rest of his life. Pre-Keynesian because he never lost the consciousness of power, the role of monopoly that had animated the progressive and institutionalist traditions. And post-Keynesian because he always remained more willing to use the power of the state than Keynes himself, who was actually a liberal, who wanted the state to be integrated with the market, was willing to do. Dad never deferred to the self-image of the corporation masquerading behind the marketplace. When there was a problem, he wanted the most direct and effective policy intervention to deal with it, even if it was coming from someone who was not exactly in his political corner. And thus, a great day in family history on August 15th, 1971, when Richard Nixon announced the freeze on wages and prices, something my father had been advocating as a anti-inflation measure for, by that time, well, decades and decades. And the Washington Post called him up, said, "How do you feel?" He said, "Like the streetwalker who has just been told that not only is her profession legal, but the highest form of municipal service." Of course, after the war and a short period of learning to write as an editor at Fortune, Henry Luce said, "I taught Ken Galbraith how to write, and I've regretted it ever since." Dad came back to Harvard, was after a rather tough battle over in the aftermath of the Strategic Bombing Survey, tenured, and began what was really his high period of creativity as an economist and a professor. And here, I think, The four books, which the Library of America has republished together now in a single volume, capture the essence of our father's creative positions. The first one was American Capitalism, published in 1952, happens to be the year I was born, subtitled The Concept of Countervailing Power, which was an effort to begin to make clear that something other than anonymous and mysteriously balanced market forces were driving what was then the apparent success of the American system. That something else was the existence of institutions that could offset the untrammeled power of business, of capitalists, of corporations. The unions, the government, the scientific and the educational estate, the power of ideas, the power of laws, the power of collective bargaining. All of them played a role, and Dad encapsulated this in the opening lines of that book by saying such are the aerodynamics of wing loading that the bumblebee in principle cannot fly. It does, and he noted that in defying the august wisdom of Isaac Newton and Orville Wright, that this must make the bumblebee into a thoroughly insecure, although successful, insect. thus the American economy. Then there came a summer's inspiration, actually carried out at the library at Dartmouth, that led to reading newspapers, basically, and writing up what he found in them, that led to the first book that really dealt with the story of what had happened in 1929, the Great Crash, something that happened when Dad was 21 years old. But the history of it had been delayed by all of the intervening events, particularly the Depression and the war. And he had the inspiration to write it. And he wrote it in such a way that that book remains the canonical account of the folly that leads to financial disaster and a little bit of the aftermath of financial disaster. Something which I think began to alert the economics profession to the real danger that Galbraith posed, which was the subversion of their core principles and ideas. In this case, the notion that the Great Depression was actually caused by the collapse of private financial markets. That this played a role. And a whole little industry in the economics profession, the first, I think, of a series of anti-Galbraith industries, began to animate professional economists at that time to try and demonstrate that no, it was actually the Federal Reserve that did it, or no, it was some other force, international exchange rates, or what have you. But Dad said, you know, the obvious thing was probably right, that the stock market crash had played a very important role in the unraveling of the financial system and led later to the collapse of the banks and to the Depression. It was, at the same time, entertaining and dangerously persuasive. In 1958, possibly his most influential book, The Affluent Society, which is dedicated to Peter, not to me, a book that asked whether it was really true that scarcity was the foundation of economic thought, whether this was the right way to frame the problem in the most prosperous period, in the most prosperous country that humanity had ever seen. It's a book that challenged the idea that corporations were merely the passive mirrors of the will of the sovereign consumer, an idea that I suspect still is to be found in economics textbooks, most unfortunately, but what can you do? Disguised in the advanced versions as the optimization subject to constraint. Never mind. that suggested that maybe it was the case that what corporations did was to design products, build them, and then sell them to the public rather than working backward from what they found out that the public wanted. It raised also, in an important way, the banner of the environment for the first time, suggesting that there were larger concerns, concerns that went beyond the satisfaction of material needs. And it championed the notion that the public interest should be served alongside the private interest, and that, in fact, the challenge of the America to America was to overcome the imbalance between private affluence and public squalor, one of the great phrases that came out of that book. Should also be said that that book has one extraordinary contribution to our national culture that is present, I think, in all of your lives on at least a weekly basis to this day. Maybe several times a week, depending on how often you turn on a pundit and the television and so on. And that is the phrase, conventional wisdom. Chapter 2 of that book is entitled The Concept of the Conventional Wisdom. And it leaves me, and I think anybody else with a literary pretensions, with the undying certainty that the one path to immortality is that memorable two-word phrase. Come up with one, and you may not be able to get a royalty on it, but people will remember what you did. The book had enormous social resonance. And it's not just in the economic sphere. It really spoke to something about American society and about what was being left behind in the rush to suburban affluence, including, of course, all of those who were not so favored, the poor, the black, those who were legally and economically oppressed. And I believe it is the case that in the letter from a Birmingham jail, Martin Luther King notes that he asked for two books, the Bible and the Affluent Society. There was a pause then. The Affluent Society came out in 1958, and of course the New Frontier began in 1960-61, the Great Society in 1964-65, alongside the War on Poverty. All of these things were driven to a very substantial extent by the ideas that my father and a few others, Michael Harrington notably, articulated in the 50s and the 1960s. So a great deal of the framing of the institutions and the vast legislative program that Lyndon Johnson was able to put together in the 1960s and to pass had its intellectual foundation, at its intellectual foundation, some of the framing ideas of John Kenneth Galbraith in the 1950s and early 1960s, and he was involved directly as an advisor to Kennedy and as an advisor to Johnson until the Vietnam War broke them apart. In 1967, there came the big book, the book that he thought would be the lasting monument to his of his work, The New Industrial State, a book that was essentially on the role and the necessity for the control of corporate power, a book that from a conceptual standpoint not only built upon the critique in the Affluent Society of the core assumptions of conventional economics, but sought to go beyond that by placing organization and the study of organization on the same footing as the study of markets, with an understanding that the dominant institutions operated through organization rather than through markets, controlled markets rather than were subjected to them. Yes, there were and are and always will be many businesses, individual economic actors who are playing on a terrain governed by market forces. But the small number of large corporations that do the planning and create the technologies are the ones that need to be understood, and the ones which economics as a profession was most resistant to understanding. And this goes through, of course, the charade and comedy of corporate governance, boards of directors appointed for basically for demonstration effects by the chief executives. And it was, of course, did not escape my father's attention that the nature of executive compensation even then was that of a, as he wrote it, a thoughtful gift from the chief executive officer to himself. If the affluent society had frightened the economists, the new industrial state terrified them. And it was roundly attacked, derided as a coffee table book. Young people were discouraged from reading it, which did not work in those days. I don't know if it still works, but if it's still thought to work as an idea that you can discourage people from reading things by criticizing them. But in any event, it remained on the bestseller list for over a year. And at that time, the bestseller list was not dominated by, you know, right-wing mass purchases of books from Renouri and so forth. It's fair to say that what the new industrial state provoked was a very substantial pedagogical backlash. That is to say, the reassertion by professional economists that, oh no, really, it is the market and the competitive system under which we live, and we are in fact a free market economy, and don't pay any attention to the large corporations, the large banks, or for that matter, the big government, the social insurance programs, and everything else that had been put in place in the 20th century. Just pretend that we are operating in this completely structureless framework of an infinite number of independent consumers and an infinite number of small and powerless businesses. This departure from reality in the economic profession, I think, is a massive exercise in denial for which my father has to be held a little bit responsible. Suggesting the truth to people who desperately do not wish to hear it is a dangerous and unpredictable thing. So what is the continuing relevance of John Kenneth Galbraith's work? Peter said this a second ago. He was not an idealist. He was a realist. He saw the need to view the world as it is, through unclouded eyes, and he used his style and his wit and his critical capacity and an occasional bawdy line or two. Well, not really. If you read the books, they're quite systematically put in. It was very much in the style of those letters to Kennedy, for which my favorite example was a complaint that supersonic jets had been delivered in Karachi with all of the discretion that one would normally expect from mass sodomy on the IRT at Russia. I read that back to him in the galleys of letters to Kennedy, and he said, oh yes, I put that in so he would keep reading. But we live in a world where the need to be awake to what is happening to us and not to have our eyes clouded by our textbooks is, I think, has never been more urgent. We're living, of course, in the wake of a financial collapse that was uncannily similar, but perhaps on a larger scale, than that of 1929. Had all of the same basic features, so much so that the great crash moved right back up onto the bestseller lists in the wake of that, because people were looking for something that could explain to them what happened, and this book did. We are living in a world where we need to recognize the power of large organizations. It is true that the corporations, the great industrial corporations that dominated the scene in the 1960s, have been weakened, in many cases changed. Their technological arms have been separated off and become independent operations in California. They're much more dependent upon external financing now than they were then. But we have large organizations whose role in running, ruling, and misruling our economy and in influencing our government needs an acute critical examination. Those organizations are called banks. Banks which are publicly chartered and which are there to serve a public purpose, but whose value in doing so hovers right around the zero line at the moment. We need to understand what the function of the state of government actually is. In particular, we need to reverse our view, the view taught by our economists of the role of regulation, a view which always held that regulation may have benefits but has costs and should therefore be minimized because the best thing is when the market is left alone. That's a bit like saying that the nuclear reactor across the way will run best if you don't bother with the cooling fluid. It'll get hotter, you know, and that'll give you more electricity, which is true for a short while, right? Drain the radiator on your car. Every system and every advanced system functions only to the extent that the forces in it are contained to within the limits of what it can handle by appropriate regulation. And the deregulation, desupervision of the financial system blew that all the way, and what we had was the equivalent of a meltdown, something which cannot be repaired simply by adding fuel. Right, try it on your car. Drain the radiator. See what happens to the transmission, and then put gas in, see what happens. I promise you, this will be an unrewarding exercise. Dad understood this. Now, I think it was the central piece, going back to the concept of countervailing power, and how you make an advanced, a technologically advanced, interdependent society function effectively cannot be done on an unsupervised basis. And there is a need for a great new sense of public purpose to address the crucial issues that we actually face in the wake of this. Some of these are economic issues: unemployment, foreclosures, the need to provide appropriate retirement security, social insurance to protect the institutions that we actually have in the face of attacks on them that are coming. And some of them, here I get to my finally, some of them are intensely evident to us, prefigured in a different way in the affluent society, which was concerned a lot about beauty and emergent issue of pollution. But intensely evident to us is the challenge of climate change. We experienced that here. I was here, by the way. Up on my hilltop when Irene came over, and on an even larger scale, that's just been experienced in New York and the coast of New Jersey. Sense of where we stand in face of the greatest challenge that any of us could ever face. It's clear that we're not prepared for it. It's clear that the only way we can prepare for it is if we organize as a society, taking the public purpose seriously. And if we rebuild our economics, not simply around some abstract notion of economic growth, or even for that matter, full employment, but around purposeful action to address the actual physical, planetary environmental challenges that we must face if we're going to continue to live pleasant, agreeable, and even tolerable lives. I think that's very much the spirit that Dad would have us operate in if he were still with us, which, thanks to the extraordinary action of Marlboro College in bringing our parents' books here, I'm fair to say that in important ways, at least on this campus, he is still with us. Thank you very much.